Hello and welcome back, everyone, to the Research VR podcast. I'm your host, Oz Balabanian, the podcast behind science and design of virtual reality. With me today is guest Aldis Sipilens from IBM, who is the head of virtual reality and game design at IBM. Hello, Aldis. How you doing?
Hey, Oz. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. And, of course, our usual co-host, Peter Lickoff.
Hello, everyone.
Aldis, so you have a really interesting background that I guess really intrigued us into having a conversation with you. And some of the reasons why you are in this field align very much with why we are here as well. You have a PhD in psychology, you're a cognitive neuroscientist, and it's clearly you're working in the industry using all of these interesting psychological background. Let's start a little bit there in terms of your background, how you ended up in your field, and tell us a little bit about what drew you in there.
Sure. So my background's in psychology, studying brain training video games, actually, at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, studying brain training games, then also just using games for skill acquisition and skill transfer. So I was really interested in the idea of using games to enhance cognitive performance. I think games are a great natural motivator, and they tap into these really fundamental human desires for exploration and mastery. And I thought we could tap into that to try to, you know, whether it's delay Alzheimer's or make people smarter. It just seemed like there was a lot of possibility there. I was in grad school in about my third year, I think, and then one day my PhD advisor calls me into his office, and he says, "Hey, Oculus just sent me a DK1 headset. I don't know what to do with it. Do you want it?" So obviously I wanted it, and being the responsible scientist that I am, the first thing I used it for was to play Minecraft.
And for science.
Like, I remember having to buy those Razer Hydra third-party motion controllers and, you know, strap them to your head and use a third-party script to run Minecraft VR. But that first moment when I like peeked my head around a Minecraft cube, that was just the closest thing I had experienced to magic. And that was kind of a big moment for me. I decided then that I wanted to devote my career to sort of studying this technology and what it could accomplish.
And that, I don't think that even had positional tracking, right? DK1 back in the day was just a 3DOF headset with...
Yeah, right. But you could finagle position tracking if you bought these Razer Hydra controllers and strapped them to your head.
Oh, a friend of mine, I remember, actually made a variant with a PSVR Move controller strapped to his DK1. Sure. But yeah, I guess that makes sense. And so it's the parallax movement that really like sold you on what... on this display technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess let's talk a little bit in terms of what you were just saying there of how games and video games have an effect, a positive effect on your mental cognition. I'm guessing you kind of grew up playing video games and you were interested into why this is so compelling. Or tell us a little bit about
that. Yeah, well, I mean, I was a huge, huge video game nerd my whole life growing up. And then I discovered in undergrad studying psychology that they were actually a valid, you know, topic of study. I thought that was great. What honestly, what first got me into wanting to study the psychology of games was I've always been a huge, achievement hunter. It's always been a big motivator for me in games. But I have gamer friends who, you know, enjoy games as much as I do, but couldn't care less about it. And I thought that must correlate with some sort of, you know, personality traits, and I was really fascinated by that. So I went into grad school with the goal of making the first standardized video game experience questionnaire. I remember meeting with like the head of the North American Psychometric Society, and then decided that that wasn't all that exciting, and got into some other topics instead.
Cool. I mean, at the top of your head, what are some interesting things that people can learn about in, with video games and mental health?
So most people know about brain training video games and all the sort of bad press they've gotten, you know, with Lumosity having to pay $2 million in false advertising. And that was sort of what I studied, was brain training games. And there's not a lot of evidence showing they help healthy people get smarter, but they're really great for, you know, cognitively impaired populations, or, you know, delaying the onset of neurodegenerative diseases. I think basically whatever you're doing, if you just employ principles of game design to make it more engaging and intuitive, it just benefits from it. Like, a lot of psychology studies involve administering these, whether the paper and pencil or computerized tests of memory and attention, and they're just incredibly dull and long and take forever and aren't very fun. And so even just gamifying those slightly to make them engaging, means you get better performance out of people. There's more signal in the data you collect. So even on a basic level, I think games are powerful there for human research.
Yeah, and I think you tapped on something interesting there with, I guess, Lumosity and what they were essentially meant out to be, with training people who have better memory and being able to recall things better. Clearly, I'm not able to do that. Maybe I need some Lumosity.
I'm in New York City, so there might be sirens sometimes.
No worries. Thankfully, the Tuesday sirens happened in SF already. The ones that sound like from World War II, the air raid sirens.
Oh, the air raid sirens, yeah.
Yeah. From what I remember in college, we learned about Lumosity basically, and the conclusions that people were able to make was that Lumosity helps you become better at the games that Lumosity has created, at those tasks themselves, rather than generalized learning. So, I mean, is that something similar to what you discovered?
Yeah, you basically just summed up the entire literature. You're like, yeah, it makes you better at if you practice anything, you get better at it. But all of brain training relies on this concept of transfer, or generalizing, or transferring what you've learned from one skill to another. And this has always been... Oh, are you raising your hand to ask a question?
What would be with a game that actually has a combination of all different types of learning? So let's say like a game that has Sudoku, a game that has all kind of different board games and all kind of different rules. Would that actually, while training each specific task, actually, you know, kind of still do a better effect of the whole brain?
Individually, each one of those games, you'd expect it to improve the related cognitive skills and anything, you know, related to it. But whether there's a more gestalt effect of, like, on the whole, they benefit you more, I don't actually know. But this has always been the problem, especially in brain training, is this idea of transfer, and no one's really been able to show it. Practicing a working memory game for a couple weeks, memorizing letters might make you a little better at memorizing numbers, but it doesn't help you remember where you put your keys, because those are very different things. And I think this is where VR comes in, because I think it largely solves this problem of presence and ecological validity. Because, I mean, basically all psych studies are done on psych undergrads in a lab setting somewhere.
Yes.
And so wanting to apply those to real-world cognition is pretty tricky. But you put a VR headset on someone and make them legitimately believe they're somewhere else, and all of a sudden the data you collect, I think, becomes a lot more meaningful.
Yeah, it's that ability to control more variables and to reproduce the test with as least amount of variance as possible, right?
Mm-hmm. And even beyond that, there are these sources of signal that have always been sort of prohibitive. Like I spent a good part of grad school running subjects through brain training studies through an MRI machine. And I could never quite shake this nagging thought that, you know, wheeling someone into a tube and having them memorize word lists through angled mirrors while responding on a button box had very little to do with real life. But now you can just stick an EEG set inside a Vive and collect that data while someone does a natural behavior they would do in real life.
And you can also use NIRS, near infrared endoscopy, so you can actually take out the subject of the tube and combine at least the upper part of the brain together with the EEG signal and actually get more information. I think there was recently a post about actually a mobile MEG. So they made a cap, so there's an MEG, which is technically similar to EEG, just uses a magnetic signal, but not just the electric. And when you combine this, at some point in technology, you can literally have a subject run around in the VR doing whatever he does and actually monitor every of his features, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And where it gets really powerful is when you start to incorporate multiple brain imaging modalities. Like you mentioned NIRS. That's a really nice supplement to EEG, because EEG has this insane temporal resolution, sampling tens of thousands of times per second, but you can't say where a signal is coming from. Whereas with NIRS, or like MEG, you can know where it is, but the temporal resolution isn't great. So put them together and you get a really great idea of what's going on inside the brain. I was planning on running a study where we had purchased like a combined EEG NIRS setup that would work with the Vive. I was worried that the EEG signal might that there'd be a lot of noise from the headset, but surprisingly there was none. If anything, the signal may have been stronger in the VR condition because the Vive headset like applied pressure. Mm-hmm. That was sort of an unexpected finding.
One of the studies I was involved in with the University of Osnabrück was this benchmark of EEG systems, and we did a small test with a phantom head, It was technically designed for testing EEG systems, but what we did, so a colleague of mine who used to be a co-host, Krzysztof Zdewski, he actually tried putting Oculus and Vive systems on this Phantom head, which had like a few dipoles inside, and we could actually measure that there is not much when any interference with a brain signal from those headsets. So the only problem is the headset tearing down the electrons, but everything else is fine.
Yeah, who knew?
So, I mean, is this something that you can see really VR growing into in terms of incorporating more sensors? Because it's already a head-worn display. It's a very intimate and let's say suction-mounted thing to your head. Plus, eye tracking, I think, is gonna serve as a huge form of input, if not, you know, also data analytics and tracking. Do you see like EEGs and other forms of tracking actually being a factor in headsets in the future?
Oh, absolutely. It's just a matter of time. Yeah, but personally, I think that every part of the headset that touches your skin where there aren't sensors right now is just wasted real estate. I think two generations from now, we're going to have eye tracking standard, and I'd be surprised if there wasn't some sort of either EMG or galvanic skin response or EEG sensors embedded into the headset.
Right. No, I think the second generation is probably where we're going to see eye tracking already integrated, and if not the... are the EMGs the trackers that I've seen on the foam aspect of the headset that are tracking your facial expressions?
They are. So what you can do is you can technically put few electrodes around your eyes, and because an eye is such a strong dipole, when it moves around, you can measure the electrical signal. And when you train the machine learning algorithm to actually, from the signal of those different electrodes, figure out where your eye looks like, or at which point you can actually even extract where how deep you're looking inside the space. So with such a method, you could basically solve the problem of foveated rendering, or actually even, you know, depth projection. So you could actually fake something like a light field. In addition to that, there is also the Tesla suit, right? I mean, if they actually manage to build the suit, you have like MAG, you have heart rate, you have skin conductance, not MAG, you have the heart rate, the skin conductance, you have the temperature measurement units, as well as all kind of different other sensors. And it's very impressive when you combine that with an EEG, with MEG, whatever you have on your head, right? And you get all this information out of a person. As you said, every inch of the skin is a waste real estate. So more sensors, better information, better prediction of the user wants.
Absolutely. And I think both in terms of, you know, signal for some sort of data analytics, but also for tangible, you know, VR benefits. Like, I think it wouldn't be a lot of work to have just a simple machine learning classifier distinguish what facial expression you're doing by a couple of embedded EMG sensors.
Yeah, that is, I think, will be a huge element, right? Is the social VR avatars will need to be more expressive. And one of the ways that that's going to happen is through your eyes, but more importantly is every other muscle that's on your face. How is that going to move? And up until now, I thought that maybe cameras will be able to solve that, right? A camera facing your mouth, maybe some cameras in the headset looking at your eyes, but I think there's things that are missing there. In terms of like beyond faces, what do EEGs, what kind of benefits can developers expect when you have more forms of tracking that are embedded?
From a developer standpoint, I think you can expect sort of effective, easy metrics on just basic engagement and like if they're asleep or not. But I think there's a lot more interest from a research side when you can really dive in. I've never personally been that much of a fan of brain activity as input. You know, I played Throw Trucks with Your Mind in VR, and I remember doing the Star Wars Force Trainer. But it always seems sort of hokey to me, and there's very limited scale there. And I think a lot of people, and like, it's not think a fireball and you make a fireball, which I think a lot of people kind of think it is. You have to, you know, predefine particular patterns and then try to recreate those. And usually you can recreate them by just raising your eyebrow or something. Where I'm much, much more of a bigger fan of BEG and brain activity just as an input to a machine learning system. It's sort of like a black box approach. It's just data going in to predict other data. No room for interpretation. It doesn't change over time. It's not, because everyone's brain is a unique snowflake. We're all different, and our patterns of brain activity are changing all the time, which makes brain activity as input sort of tricky. But it's an incredibly rich source of signal for machine learning.
And the problem with those BCI interfaces, right? It's also that the amount of data you can get per second is not very high. So you can use the P300 or some other event-related potentials that you can actually use to steer all different things in your game. But the delay between you actually producing the spike is like 300 milliseconds, while it's, you know, the P300. And in addition to that, you also have the limitation of only, you know, 2-3 decisions per second. It's not much. Raising your eyebrow, you can do way faster. And that's also an issue. But if you actually use it to read out certain information through machine learning from those signals and actually can help the application to understand better what your desire is, what your goal is, what your state is, I guess that's something that might be very interesting for a developer, because it can be, because then they can very precisely control the environment.
No, I definitely agree that this idea of using sensor data sort of get a richer picture of someone's sort of cognitive state. I think there's a ton of value there.
Speaking of like BCIs and VR, I think one of the only companies that we've seen that's essentially tackling this is Neurable. Have you had a chance to check them out or try it, and what are your thoughts?
Their tech seems good. I haven't gotten to try it yet, so I'm not sure what like the signal noise rate. I haven't gotten to try it yet, so I'm not exactly sure how good the data is that they're collecting, but I imagine it's pretty good. It seems like non-invasive and like comfortable. I think it's a step in the right direction for sure.
Right. And I think one of the things they're really interested in or excited about was the fact that they want to use it as input for 3D manipulation. Because up until now, like all the cheap toys that we've seen at least have been like emotive or whatnot, where you can move something up or down. That's essentially on a one, or is that two dimensional? Oh, that's one dimensional, right? It just moves up and down. I think their breakthrough before they had applied it to VR was that they can actually manipulate something in, must have been two directional, because they were moving like a toy car. So I guess that's interesting that it's, if we have more forms of input, perhaps they can help you augment the things that you're doing. Or is that,
I mean, perhaps,
not so interesting?
But I think for any sort of really complex control, for it to be better than any sort of other source of input, there needs to be a fundamental difference in how we're approaching it. It can't just be predefined patterns of brain activity then try to recreate them. I think we've hit the edge of where that stops being interesting.
Right. So let's transition this into how, you know, where does IBM come into this, and how did you end up in IBM?
Sure.
Expected to work on virtual reality and video games.
So in grad school, after I got my hands on a DK1 and I was studying brain training and cognitive assessment, I founded a VR lab where I started making cognitive assessments in Unity. It was my first time trying out the Unity game engine. And the idea was, we're testing all these cognitive abilities like memory and attention, and we want to generalize to the real world. Well, we live in 3D, so I think it makes sense to test in 3D. So whipped up some prototypes, and it just made a lot of sense to me. And studying brain training at the time, it wasn't that big of a leap for me to realize that there's a lot of potential there. So I co-founded a company and got some venture capital funding. I gave a startup pitch at SVVR. Then I was part of the Rothenberg Ventures River program in San Francisco for a few months.
Yeah.
And had a booth at TechCrunch in San Francisco. Did the whole startup thing, was part of the San Francisco VR scene for a little bit. And it was great. It was an amazing learning experience. But I realized a little bit too late that I hate the startup life. That as the CEO of a startup, you spend half your time writing emails, the other half fundraising, and you get to do very little actual research and design. So luckily around that time, someone from IBM had actually been to a New York VR meetup where I'd given a talk, and they invited me to the lab and then offered me a job, and one thing led to another, and then, yeah.
You're like, finally, I get back to my roots of, you know, researching and producing and not
exactly,
having
to
do usual CEO stuff.
Part of the appeal of the job was that it was sort of wide open. They were part of my job was figuring out how IBM could make money with VR and immersive tech. So sort of seeing what sort of enterprise B2B use cases there were and how IBM tech could add value to that. So I did a lot of sort of job skills training and education prototypes in VR. And then some more sort of out there experimental prototypes for looking at sort of the future of AI and how that could come into play. One of the early projects we did was with brain imaging, actually, where we had people do a memory task either in VR or on a flat screen. It was a simple task where just these colored orbs appear. You have to remember which one is which color. And then while they played it, they were in just a Muse EEG headset, just consumer grade. And we wanted to see if we could predict whether or not you would remember something based on your brain activity when you saw it. So we used brain activity during the encoding period, like while the objects were flashing, while you see the stuff you're supposed to remember, and then use just that brain activity to predict if within that trial you remembered the object. And we were able to show that we were able to do that prediction, but only in VR. Somehow brain activity had more predictive signal in VR than on a flat screen when the task was, at least from a cognitive perspective, identical.
So could you say that the encoding itself was different based on the display method that you're using?
Unless we were just getting better signal in VR and there's something fundamentally different there, that's really the only explanation that makes sense to me. I think it's something to do with how it was encoded, and I think it's something to do with presence. The follow-up study, we wanted to do it in real time. So in the original study, we collected all this data, then ran these post-hoc analyses. In the follow-up, I was wondering, well, what if we know you're going to forget something based on your brain activity, why don't we just show it again? So I wanted to have people do the task again and then construct these personalized machine learning models for when we think you're going to forget something. And then have them do the task, then on a quarter of the trials, present the objects twice. Now, anything you see twice, you're going to remember better. But some of those you would have remembered anyways. So some of that is just wasted effort. So then a quarter of the trials would have been ones selected by the machine learning system as ones we think you'll get wrong. And then if we can show better performance enhancement on those compared to non, then all of a sudden we've validated personalized closed-loop neurofeedback in VR to enhance cognition.
It's a very fascinating kind of proof for ecological validity to be actually valid for VR, right? So when you actually can figure out signal correlation with a certain behavior, better in VR, it's actually the fundamental proof that we should use VR. As you know, basically the research I've been doing and a lot of research I have been doing with VR to show that, you know, VR is not just worse to be researched, but VR is also a valid research tool.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I hadn't actually thought of that in terms of ecological validity, but you're right. That is actually pretty good evidence for that.
And maybe let's define ecological validity, actually. We've talked about it way early on in the podcast, but...
Yeah, sure. Ecological validity is just how much what you study in the lab applies to the real world.
Yes.
Right, and VR being a immersive display and you having real manipulation of things, you can make that basically assumption that it can be more ecologically valid in VR than on a 2D display, or at least ecologically valid conclusions from a study to the real world.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that there's, I mean, every hilarious gif of someone hurting themselves in VR is evidence of ecological validity, especially for those just poorly designed apps, like that one, there's a pool app for VR, and then unsurprisingly, there's pictures of people hurting themselves because they're leaning on the pool table. Like, that's how you play pool in real life. That should happen. That means VR is working.
Right. Yeah, you totally lean on the thing. I've done that before where I've like dropped my controller on a fake table and it like
fell through,
right?
Yeah, so when you basically think of a typical G experiment, when you have like a red dot and a blue dot on the screen and you have your pop-up effects at P300, there is actually not much real-life scenarios in the world that do resemble this particular task, but there is actually one paper, I will link it in the show notes. So did an experiment in VR, I think it was even in the early 2000s, where you would drive around in a virtual city and there were like traffic lights and they were sometimes red and sometimes they popped out blue or green and on the paper. I don't remember the colors anymore, but it was actually having the same effect. And when you just compare those two experiments, one is you're sitting in a flat screen looking at this dot appearing in a dark room, and the other one is actually in VR engaging with this, you know, car driving, and there are actually the traffic lights, and they produce the same effect. It's kind of the proof for ecological validity. So the same effect actually happened in the real world. And the question is always how applicable something that you did in your study in your very small subsample group actually reflect what's happening in the real world. One of the talks or one of the papers, I think, at the VRST where I've been publishing my paper was that they tried Amazon Mechanical Turk, I think it's called, to actually crowdsource subjects for the experiment. So they did a few very simple experiments for like pop-out effects or actually looking around or detecting things. They probed them in Unity, they looked like very simple, but they were working with a cardboard, and they got 1,000 people, they sent out the cardboard, and actually he showed statistics that I think 700 people of those completed it, 50 they, kicked out, and then they had a sample of 650 people. That was just super good. So VR can also help you crowdsource your subjects, and you can repeat the same experiment in any place of the world, no matter how the lab looks like. You don't have to prepare it physically. You just, basically get the person out of the real into the virtual world.
Right, right. This relates to, I've been wondering for a while if the possibility of collecting useful behavioral data just by releasing something on Steam. I don't know a lot of researchers who, put out an experiment on Steam for free for anyone to try, but it seems like a great source of data. You'd anonymize the data and collect everything, responsibly, but this is definitely a path I'm very interested in and would love to release something at some point.
Yeah, I think the distribution channels and the platforms that the research use have a big effect on the desire for someone to actually do it and how accessible that is, right? I mean, if they're being paid or not, and they're not being paid. Just because it's more familiar, it's already more accessible. Plus, most research is like a 15-minute questionnaire you have to answer on Google, forms, and that's not that engaging.
Right, right. And I mean, you're going to get a lot of noisy data, but I think it's worth it just for the sheer amount of it you'd get.
Right. So I guess to kind of steer it back into IBM, where I've seen VR intercepting with what IBM's been doing is through Watson. They've probably been one of the earliest people into machine learning and AI, and maybe you can kind of tell us a little bit of the work that you've done there.
Yeah, sure. So I think IBM's main value add to VR is through Watson. Because voice recognition and voice input is just such a useful tool in VR when all of a sudden you can't just reach out and use a keyboard as easily anymore. And IBM has released the Watson Unity SDK. It's been out for a little bit. It's great. I strongly encourage you try it out. They've done a few hackathons around it. There was the Star Trek Bridge Crew VR game that used Watson for NPCs. So that's been sort of the main IBM play in the area that I've seen.
In terms of the hackathons, have you been there to kind of see what ideas are percolating through and maybe incorporating some of those into the game design that you're trying to build?
That one was on the other side of the country, but I got to see some of the demos that came out of it, and it was pretty cool. It was a lot of there were a couple involving computer vision and sort of drawing an object in the air with your fingers and then recognizing it and then generating it. And I think especially with the release of the Google Poly API, all of a sudden that gets a lot more interesting.
It's fascinating. I think it was Tipitat, the VR investor, that was talking about this on a podcast. Oh, it was the Draper, the Boost VC podcast, where he was like, I'm surprised nobody's made a Scribblenauts type of game in VR where you draw out the thing that you're thinking about and it creates that object and then that becomes a game element. Scribblenauts was awesome for that reason. You guys remember that game
on the
Nintendo DS?
Right, right.
It was the most sandboxy game ever.
I remember that too, but I remember also the developers saying everyone thinks it's just this magical sandbox we created, but really they just manually programmed everything.
Yeah, I guess the equivalent of that would be Job Simulator and Rick and Morty VR, where there's all these interesting interactions between the objects that you only can know if you try it out. But I'm sure they've had to hard code those in.
Oh yeah, and they're in the Alchemy Labs presentation. They describe that, and they show this the biggest Excel spreadsheet I've ever seen, where they tested every possible combination. Yeah, it was amazing.
Oh my god, the trees! I can imagine how far down deep they go. Star Trek Bridge Crew was a pretty big release in VR, and I think that was probably one of the first games that had the voice as input. How does that, I guess, implement? Have you seen that being implemented into other games now and in new and exciting ways that can help you be more efficient?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge role for voice input for whether it's gaming or enterprise. The problem overall is it works most of the time with most people. And so having some blank spots, it's harder for kids, or I know IBMers who struggle with the Australian accent, or if anyone has an accent that sort of messes with it. But long term, I think that's definitely the solution.
is, yeah, at least voice being part of the input method rather than
absolutely, yeah.
But then again, I was trying recently this mixed reality headset from Lenovo, and it was like my first time setting up mixed reality on my laptop. And when Cortana was trying to convince me for the seventh time to actually close an application with my voice and not do it like I'm used to doing VR, it was a little bit invasive. I understand the value when I just lie back on my sofa and I just enjoy wonderful VR experience, and I can say to my computer, okay, open now this website and scroll down or launch this application. However, I think with people's a general reaction to voice assistants, I mean, yes, there is a big acceptance for example Alexa or Google Voice, but in general people don't talk that much to their computers. Like you see Siri on the MacBook or actually Cortana on the Windows PC is not performing that well. So
right.
Would it be different in VR? Will it be more natural in VR? Or
well, yeah, I mean, the example you gave is just awful. Like in that case, if you're sitting at your computer with your hand on your mouse, you're going to close a window faster with the mouse than with a voice command. That's just, I can see that being obtrusive and annoying. But yeah, I think there's definitely all sorts of applications in VR where it could make sense. I mean, I think we have to solve some problems in terms of text-to-speech and speech-to-text accuracy. I also think there's going to be, over time, this adjustment where we get more used to it, because it's becoming more and more standard to have, whether it's a, you know, Alexa or whatever in your house. Like I've started using one for the first time just a few months ago, and I'm not getting more used to talking out loud to nobody like a crazy person. And I think in time that'll just get more and more normal.
I mean, just to add to that, I think even when I'm sitting in a public setting with AirPods in my ears and I'm speaking, I'm starting to become more comfortable or actually making gestures that people understand that I'm actually speaking to someone, whether that person is a human or an AI. It doesn't particularly matter, but you're not just that crazy person on the street just speaking to yourself. I think as a society, we're like now developing those social and structural gestures that indicate certain things that we haven't had to deal with before.
No, definitely, yeah. And in the same way that young people are just better and seem more natural at VR than old people, I think that's the same thing with voice integration. It'll just be the newer generations will just be more used to it, and yeah.
But
you look like you disagree.
I partly agree. However, when you mention the elderly people, so I've been showing VR to a lot of people in different fairs, and to my surprise, someone who tried to explain his parents, or at least my mother, how to use a laptop, how to use Windows, how to use, you know, basically websites, people who just never used VR, just, you know, are easily over 60 or 65 sometimes, putting it on and being very natural with it. Always surprised me regards that maybe VR is not that difficult, and maybe it's not that hard to be very intuitive in VR. So sure, the young people or particularly kids are better.
I think it depends on the. I think it depends on the app and on the UI. But I guess the main example is that I've seen personally is Tiltbrush. That for a long time that was my sort of go-to VR demo. And I was surprised because whenever you put someone over 40 in Tiltbrush, they tend to paint on an imaginary flat canvas in front of them. Where put someone under 10 in VR and they'll make a virtual pillow fort and sit in it, or make a glittering rainbow dress and go stand in it. Because yeah. I think these young kids don't have a lifetime of interacting with flat media to get over. They've already been using touchscreens their whole lives, so it's just more normal.
Right. I noticed, I think the biggest difference with kids and older people is that kids are way more likely to take that step forward or backwards when they're wearing a Vive or a Rift, whereas people even our age, you know, they put it on and they kind of stand still, and perhaps they're drawing or painting in air, but they won't even realize that there is that possibility of stepping. With kids, like when they see a virtual object that they want to grab, they don't care. They just walk in that direction and grab the thing, and they expect for things to work. And you know, thankfully it all works. And it's fascinating to see how easy it is for, I guess, a more permeable brain to be able to understand the rules of this game and the rules of this universe and play along those rules. I guess you were talking about education earlier. Do you want to go a little bit deeper into how you think VR can be a part of that?
I joined IBM in the education group, but like it's not exactly my focus or specialty. I think more generally I'm interested in sort of I want to give people superpowers in VR. That's sort of, if I had to sum up my research agenda.
And so let's talk about those superpowers.
So there's this great project out of Disney, their research labs, where they had people catch a tennis ball in VR, and it was a real tennis ball with trackers on it. And they started putting in all these little visual helpers. Like they would show them. Like, so you're wearing in VR, you can still either pass through cameras, so you can still see the real world. So they had you do the task in VR, and then people could catch the ball basically at normal rates. So the tracking was good, latency was low enough, and then Disney started putting in all these visual helpers to try to help people. Like they would show a predicted curve or like a predicted target location of where the ball would end up, and people just totally ignore them. They don't provide any really, really useful information. If anything, they kind of impaired performance because it's just more noise. But then they removed the ball. So in VR, you could no longer see the ball that was flying towards you. You had to catch it just based on its predicted target location next to you. And all of a sudden, people started catching it like a weird robot because that's the only thing they can do with the visual information they've given. And this is it's a weird looking behavior that I was fascinated by because you could really only do it in VR. You can try to catch a ball like that in real life, sure, but you're not as good at it. But in this VR environment, VR is the only one where you can remove sensory information. Augmented reality, you can put stuff on top. Real life, you need to change the actual environment. VR, you can just take something out of the picture, and I think this enables some really interesting, totally new behaviors that you just couldn't do before.
Right. I think it actually goes to that method of training where when you're training, you're actually making things harder for yourself so that when you're performing in as an athlete, you can then do better than the training environment that you're in. I think I've heard of like soccer players wearing these, I don't know if they're glasses that are blinding them every nth, millisecond, but it basically makes it harder for you to see. And once you take that off, or even the breathing masks, right? It makes it harder to breathe, and after you take that
Right,
off,
yeah.
supposedly you'll be
I've
able
heard of
to do
those.
better.
Heard of those masks being used for hockey players. And this relates back to this idea in the skill acquisition literature and psychology of it's called variable priority training, which is so that means just doing the same task but focusing on a different part of it, just mentally. And even that will lead to better performance. And so I think being able to just tweak little parts of a training setting can lead to big boosts in behavior. I had this idea of now that we have eye tracking, we know when saccades and blinks happen. So what about a change detection task where you're just in a VR room and when you blink or your eyes do a saccade, just change something and see if they notice?
Yeah, I think there's so much you can do with change blindness in VR, whether it's part of like a game design or actually part of, you can probably play with a lot with like implicit effects on people and by changing lighting and things around the room without them particularly noticing it and having that be a positive effect on someone rather than suggesting them to buy things. Although you can see it go down that road as well.
In one of the applications is redirected walking, right? Where you actually take people to run in a very huge room while being very limited space around you, right? And I think when we can actually not only detect saccades with those eye tracking sensors in the headset, but also microsaccades can give actually even more information because microsaccades can predict how interested you are in a certain thing even better, or through the pupil dilation, you can measure the stress, engagement, and some other factors. And this can give even more information for the algorithms to actually play around with.
Oh, definitely. One of the coolest VR research projects I've seen in a while has been the work at NVIDIA they're doing with redirected walking and saccades, where they detect they're actually they elicit saccades by just putting bright lights on the scene and making your eye move to it, and then because you're totally blind to whatever happens during a saccade, while a saccade is happening, they'll shift the camera a little bit so you can't notice, and then in this way they just it would just enhance existing redirected walking techniques by giving you even more room to switch stuff around.
So the crazy thing is that during a saccade, your eyes are actually kind of blind. So the brain really sees only the picture while you're focusing, but during the saccades, you can do this trick. It's actually very impressive that we perceive the world so clearly, so fluent, but basically, how often do saccades occur? 30, 40, 50 times per second, right? Depending on the microsaccades, not saccades, you're basically blind for certain time of your vision.
A third, I think, a third of your vision is blindness, is your eye moving, right? Something along those lines. But yeah, this all fills in itself to a beautiful fluid motion of vision. It's pretty impressive. I was going to say, are those like when you find the limits of your vision, does that give you an opportunity to perhaps innovate on or to build superpowers into?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really interested in sort of hacking the human perceptual and cognitive system, sort of finding the weaknesses and exploiting them. In this case, I mean, it's bad that we just don't take in visual information while our eyes are doing a saccade. So let's use that. Let's use that to change the scene, or heck, we could just use that for extra buffer cycles. I don't know. There's all sorts of stuff we could do with that. Plenty of foibles in the human body we could exploit for immersive tech.
Actually, the idea to not render the frames that are, you know, during a saccade would also be in addition to just the foveated rendering, where you render only in high detail where you're looking at. But if you can actually drop the frames, it would, I guess, also yield like at least half of the frames being useless and being kicked out. So you can clear up the buffer, right?
Sure, yeah.
I have a question, actually, because it seems like you guys are very well versed in vision. Facebook showed off a headset, you know, this new prototype headset that has both eye tracking and also a much wider field of view. And from what it seems like, the peripheral side of that wide FOV is way more blurry. It has less resolution, right? You don't need to mess with that as much. And from what I know and from what I've experienced by wearing a Gear VR is that our peripheral vision actually has, let's call it a high refresh rate, or it can detect motion quicker than you can in your fovea, which is the reason why I think every time I wear a 60 hertz headset like the Gear, I see the refresh rate of the headset in my periphery of my vision. Do we have like variable refresh panels that work on that? Peter's nodding yes.
So in fact, have the different pathways and also the different speed of processing information. So when you're dealing with color information, which is mostly in the fovea area, right, you basically need more processing power to get the colors right, to distract them. And it's not as fast as the peripheral areas where you basically have only the black and white detectors. And that's also the reason why, you know, while technically you can only detect 24 frames, like consciously, you notice the flickering with your peripheral vision, which triggers, you know, an interest in that area. And that's why actually those high frequency screens are useful, not because you can detect it actually with your main small fovea, but actually with the sides. So that's why you also have those ambient lights and whatever.
That's fascinating. At least for like pro gamers or people that are really into it, the 144 hertz displays that they buy, it's not even about the where you're looking. And that's not the high refresh rate that you're seeing. It's more for the things that are happening in the periphery of your vision, so you can quickly, you know, move your mouse and hit that target. Yeah, that's totally fascinating. But I think, I'd be curious to know. I don't know if OLED displays or AMOLED displays have I know they have variable refresh rates, so it's not locked to whatever, you know, like the 60 or 90. But maybe like individual pixels or subpixels are actually moving are turning on and off at different rates to account for that.
So I think that with certain types of panels, you can have this black screen in between you basically changing the color. So I think the reason why certain panels were preferred for the Oculus version were because they actually have this signal, black, signal, black, signal, black, and that removes the blurriness. Because when you have those black moments in between and the panel can actually do it, then you actually have a way smoother picture. But I think that either OLED or LCD, one of them couldn't actually do it. I don't remember which one but I think the OLED ones can actually have the black in between and the LCD ones not, because they have a backlight illumination. It's kind of harder to flash it, I guess.
Yeah. And, cool. I mean, traditionally, LCD displays are slower, too, in terms of refresh rates.
Yes.
Right.
But they fixed those, apparently.
Absolutely. So you have this wonderful picture of this weird ball on your Twitter page. What's all about this?
Oh, yeah, the ball. So this was a part of a project, started off as tentative title 3D printed VR Roomba basketball, where so I was inspired by the Disney study, and I thought they showed this cool new human behavior and when it came to catching a ball, but what about throwing one? So we designed and printed a sort of 3D shell for an HTC Vive tracker that it sort of like screws into itself. And then we bought a Roomba and hooked it up to a Raspberry Pi and had it talk to Unity, and then put a laundry basket on it, and then had the Roomba drive around and had people throw this VR ball into it, either in real life or in VR. And we would just change what they saw in the different conditions.
Cool. And what did you end up finding out about?
Ultimately, we found that you could change the visual representation in VR in such a way to enhance performance, which is really what we were going after. But it was a great sort of process of discovery. As soon as the first person we sort of tested out on this task, where you just stand there and the Roomba would drive around and you throw the ball into it, the Roomba has to stop to turn. And so the first person would just wait for it to stop and then throw then, and the task gets way easier then. And so at that point, it basically becomes a study about like who figures out this optimum strategy or not. And that made me realize that that's really what I was interested in, was if we could use VR as a way to teach someone an optimal strategy and force them to use it, but remove visual sensory information to force them to use the optimal strategy in VR so that then after VR, they take the headset off, they'll still use that same strategy they learned in VR, but in real life. So we decided to turn a feature into a bug, and we realized that hitting the Roomba when it was stationary was much easier. So we switched to Nerf guns. So we bought a Nerf gun, stuck a VR tracker on it, did photogrammetry on it, put a Raspberry Pi on the trigger switch, and then modeled the physics in Unity, and then had you shoot a dodgeball that was just sort of standing on top of the Roomba as it drove around. And then we tried actually, I had this idea to use the camera, or use the microphone on the Vive to detect the sound of when a shot had been fired, which worked. It just added a little bit too much latency, unfortunately, so we had to go the Raspberry Pi route. In this experiment, we had three groups. You did this task either in real life with no VR headset, you're just shooting a ball on a Roomba, or you did it in VR where we recreate the real world sort of visuals. So you see the photogrammetried Roomba and the target driving around. Then a VR version where you don't see the Roomba. The only thing you see is a target in the predicted location where it will next stop, as well as a timer for when it's going to get there. And so with this information, people tend to do this task by sort of like tracking the Roomba and deciding when they should shoot. But with this new visual information, you can't do that. The only thing you can do is go where you know it's going to be. That's the only visual information you have. And so the idea was, if we force some people to do this in VR, would they then do it outside of VR? And we had some preliminary minor data showing that like the strategy would transfer like that, but you need that sort of within subject study design, you need a ton of subjects. We were able to show enhanced performance in the VR condition, which is sort of unsurprising. One interesting finding was in the VR special targeting condition. So normally, if you try to hit a target, you're more accurate if it's closer. There's like a really predictable curve of accuracy versus distance. That curve just goes away in the VR targeting condition. All of a sudden, distance didn't even matter anymore. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Why is that so? Is it because you're already showing the target and the trajectory of the target, or?
Yeah, I think in this particular task, difficulty scales with distance in the real-life condition with a moving target, but with a static target, probably not. I'm sure the accuracy would still go down with enough distance, but at the distances we were doing, which was like maybe 5 to 25 feet, it didn't really seem to matter.
That's fascinating. And I do want to point out that the shell that you guys made is the tracker is within this shell. And so you have, I guess, enough air gaps within that the trackers are still tracking, and you could throw it at, I'm guessing, at any speed, and it still was tracking, right?
Yeah, we tried real hard to break it with super spinny throws, and it works totally fine. Interestingly, we had a much bigger problem trying to do the tracker on the Nerf gun. We tested out all sorts of different Nerf guns, and the one we wanted to use had an electric motor in it. And then when the tracker, we had it sort of nearby the motor, and then we did all the photogrammetry, got it up and running, and the first time we tried to fire it, the gun just like flies off into space. The Vive tracker does not like vibrations.
No. The recoil of any of these VR guns, they have to create enough insulation for the vibrations to kind of like to be within like an acceptable range. I think Striker VR was showing me their latest like Vive version, and they had to like really play with the recoil to get it to work right. But yeah.
The problem is not just with the recoil weapons, but as a colleague of mine is trying to make a chair trackable, he basically used this open source kit for the Vive tracking system. And the problem was when he actually placed the PCB computing unit under the chair and you would sit down, the vibration of you sitting on the chair would actually let this thing fly around the space. Well, he basically solved it by putting it back on the chair where it creates less vibrations. But the fun part is he recently told me how he figured out that you can actually turn down where you can actually turn it off the feature that the tracker does not only rely on the optical system, but also on the magnetometer and accelerometer, so on the IMU. And when you actually turn off the IMU in the controllers, in the tracking unit, in the headset, then the tracking quality becomes way worse. So apparently there is a lot of sensor fusion going on in those controllers. And I guess that's why it was a ball, because it's like an acceleration that is constantly changing. So IMU might do it very well, even so it kind of loses this optical signal here and there. But with the Nerf gun, the electromagnetic stimulation, I guess, from the motor, the electromotor, and also the fact that it vibrates, apparently sends it to the space. So it's very tricky with the tracking.
Right. I've heard of some people dealing with the issue of Vive trackers and vibration by just lowering the sampling rate. That apparently helps, but not an ideal solution.
Very interesting.
The idea of superpowers is totally fascinating, and I'm dying to kind of like learn more in terms of how researchers or what questions researchers are tackling. What are some of these research ideas that you want to explore over the next 3 to 5 years?
I mean, I think like we're still in the early stages of sort of having to validate it from the ground up of showing training works in VR and it's worth doing and it works better than in real life. I think that what's worth training in VR is maybe the most important question we should be focusing on right now. Because, I mean, it doesn't make sense to train 2D algebra or, 2D geometry in VR, but it makes all the sense in the world if you're dealing with, 3D models and dangerous physical environments. And, like, as humans, we can sort of intuitively figure that out, but I think diving into the nuts and bolts of what is it about a training scenario and its use case and the perceptual, cognitive, motor fidelity of all those features that needs to line up for it to be worth doing in VR or AR.
And in terms of like certain fields or perhaps like certain things that you can train people, what have you seen that's been really effective to be training in VR for?
So anything where reality is sort of dangerous or expensive or inconvenient. One of the best use cases I've seen, actually at VR days, the guy from Deutsche Bahn who's doing training for train engineers, and he's a couple use cases where there are a couple sort of edge cases where if you do something wrong, like someone could die. Like if you're disconnecting hoses from two trains and you forgot to turn off the air pressure first, they can fly off and be really dangerous. And this is the sort of thing where you can show someone a PowerPoint slide, but having them in VR actually do it and be slightly freaked out when it happens is a much more effective. You'll come out of that experience remembering that a lot better. I saw some great examples from Deutsche Bahn as well, where they're replacing an entire fleet of trains, and normally that training people on this requires pulling the train off the tracks into a special garage, then bringing people to that location, having them examine it, and every part of that is expensive. Whereas in VR, all of a sudden you can look at whatever you want and not have to fly anybody anywhere.
One of the things I think that comes to mind was firefighter training, and you can imagine how dangerous some of those scenarios can be. And this company had built a fully photogrammetry environment and had photogrammetry scanned the objects that the firefighters will be using, the tools, and trying to make it as photorealistic as possible for the trainees. And I thought that was like a really great. Oh, actually, there was another company out of Australia that built a firefighter suit like, you know, the thing they wear on top, the jacket and the hose with a tracker on it for all to be synced for this firefighter training. And it makes you feel, you know, it heats up. It actually, I remember the hose when you let the water out, it actually pulls you back. And it was like a really like strong force. It had enough recoil that you get that realism. So I think, yeah, it makes sense. Anything that's expensive and dangerous, you can probably get some benefit that's going to be cheaper and more,
like,
safer to do.
Even the example you just gave of this firefighter training, like there exist houses that they just burn over and over again for firefighter training, but that's expensive. Yeah. And being able to do that in VR and do it better and do it more, just change little things about it to make the training more effective, I just think makes all the sense in the world.
You can imagine even recording, let's say if you're doing a team exercise and you want to practice that scenario again, you can probably just record the avatars of your teammates doing the certain thing, and then you can run that scenario multiple times. I know Striver was like probably one of the first companies that was trying to essentially build a training platform for like quarterbacks to be running the plays through. At least they were doing it through video. And now, from what we talked about last time, they're doing training for like Walmart employees. So I think training.
I heard there's a VR headset in every Walmart employee training center now.
And I mean, when you spoke previously about Watson, I guess there's also a great help from the artificial intelligence part that you could integrate in those experiences for training, because you could not only record what other people did, but actually try to make them appear a little bit more vivid and a little bit more interactive, and actually have different scripts and they can answer you with different texts, right? So this will be, I guess, also a big step.
Aldis, what's exciting you about this field for moving forward? I mean, both in your research, but also just personally in VR and AR.
I think the biggest technological advancement I'm looking forward to is eye tracking, both for, you know, foveated rendering, blah, blah, blah. But eye tracking as input just feels like magic. It's great. I mentioned I'm not a big fan of EEG brain activity as input, but eye tracking as input, it's like the computer knows what you want before you do. I think that's going to change a lot of interactions and UI sort of elements in VR. Starting to get more and more into mobile AR. I was a little bit hesitant when it first came out, just because I'd sort of paid myself into a VR corner. Like, no, I'm the VR guy. But now I'm definitely seeing the value there. I'm interested in exploring sort of cross-platform AR/VR experiences. It doesn't work for everything, but I think there are some cases where you can either design an experience or a game to be asymmetrical in such a way that where you benefit from the different, you know, one person having full body motion tracking, whereas one person just being on their phone. I think that allows for some pretty interesting experiences.
Have you played much that you would like to point out in terms of interesting or clever game design that aligns with the findings that you know?
I'm a big fan of asymmetric cooperative gameplay. My favorite game that I've played with just friends lately has been I Expect You to Die, where one person's in VR disarming a bomb and the bomb experts are not in VR telling them what to do. I think that's a great one. Actually, that and Superhot are two, they're like the exceptions to the rule of games that actually got better when they got ported to VR. Superhot was just groundbreaking for me, because for me, for the first time, I was able to like look over there, know there's a guy there, pick up a ninja star and throw it at him without looking. Like, you could never do that before. Until now, you had to press a joystick to turn the camera, press the A button, turn the camera back, press the fire button. Whereas now you can actually use your spatial awareness and, you know, proprioceptive sense and actually be aware of your environment in such a way that it benefits you, just like it would in real life. Like, I've played this level before. I know there's a shotgun up here. I don't even have to look. I can just grab it. I thought that was an amazing part of Superhot.
Yeah, it's those interactions that you can do without looking end up making you feel so cool, right? And so powerful and impressive, I think. And those end up becoming like really viral videos and people look at them. Actually, I should point this out. There's a gaming YouTuber named Crobcat. Typically he makes videos that are like satirical compilations from like gaming conventions, or like even just clips from gameplay, and he's a really good editor and ends up putting together like a really interesting narrative without speaking ever once. He put out a video where he was comparing like Call of Duty and then like the Call of Duty of VR, which he calls Pavlov. And he was kind of showing the richness of interactions that you can have, where one of the things that come to mind was like holding up a sniper rifle and with one hand, and when you fire it, it actually has so much recoil that it flies out of your hand. So you have to like hold it with two hands. He was showing that you could hold, you know, two pistols and be shooting at different directions at different people. Just the rich interactions socially that you can have, and the hilarious moments that that ensures. I think those are the type of videos and things that people outside of VR don't really know, and because the videos haven't been able to convey that yet. Little by little, I think with better game design, we're starting to have people understand like, oh, like that's why maybe like a headset and two controllers would really make a big difference in what you might be able to do. And that doesn't even touch the productivity elements of VR, the spatial computing elements of VR. That's just pure social interaction and game design. I think those are just fascinating, and I'm happy to see that start to permeate into like the mainstream.
Hey, there's one thing I wanted to bring up, which is, I mean, lately there's been I feel more and more confusion about terminology in VR and AR, like what is VR, AR, what is mixed reality. I have a proposal or a proposed way of calling things that I'd like to run by you guys, get your opinion. So basically, you can picture a Venn diagram where in the middle, there's the mixed reality circle, and then overlapping with that on either side is a VR and AR circle. VR and AR don't touch, but they both intersect with mixed reality. We know what VR is, and we know what AR is, but there's a sort of hazy area in between where I propose mixed reality is anything that's spatially aware. So Pokemon Go is pure AR. It's not mixed reality. Whereas, you know, anything where you use AR kit or AR core, it's still augmented reality. You're putting stuff on top of the real world, but it's also spatially aware, so it's mixed reality. And VR, where you just the only thing you see is the experience, that's not exactly mixed reality. But as soon as you start adding in, you know, the pass-through cameras to create mixed reality experiences, it goes into that territory of MR. Does that make sense as a proposed sort of taxonomy?
I'll second that, and I'll hereby pass the motion, and I'll put the stamp on it, and hopefully we won't have the debates on Twitter with people pulling out pie charts and Venn diagrams, and well, you see, the spectrum is between the
actually virtual augmentality, not really. Oh. Yeah, I've seen that freaking
I love the three word
whatever so many times.
I fully agree with you. So. It is actually really something that would be very beneficial if we could just agree on some kind of terminology and not every company trying to frame it differently. And also that one should actually accept those terms at some point and not just go always back to the literature, because there are more differences between mixed, real, between the augmented, between the edit, between the projected, whatever. And it's like, it's fine. We are basically doing not something helpful, but we are more and more confusing the average consumer, because he, you know, just doesn't know what am I supposed to get, right? So it's a great idea.
Yeah, sure. A Venn diagram of this and all of my talks for the future, so I'm going to be pushing this forever. Oh yeah, and by the way, XR covers everything, and the X doesn't stand for anything.
Sure, yeah, X doesn't stand for anything. XR is, I guess, the terminology for everything, but honestly, I like calling it more like spatial computing or immersive technology.
But I like it. I like immersive tech, but in my mind, immersive tech equals XR. Like those refer to the same thing.
Sure.
I think we should just pick up the new buzzwords from Microsoft from their conference and basically describe those VR headsets and our computers as edge computing. But soon we are all going to be a big cloud. So we should also distinguish between cloud VR and edge VR, cloud AR and edge AR, on.
That's the other.
There's actually, in terms of MR, there's a few new ones that, you know, the merged reality, the mixed reality. There's a few forms of mixed reality as well. And I try not to touch terminology much. I'm going to sit back, yep. Wait for the consumers to figure it out, and then we'll come back to it. Because otherwise, if it's researchers that are going to come up with, and scientists that are going to come up with naming things, then, you know, the full telephone is still, our iPhones would still be called like wireless communication devices, version 3.5. Like, so that consumers will name things, and they will, whatever will catch on will be the thing that catches on. And that is that.
You mentioned,
with that, do you want to add something to that?
You mentioned cloud computing. If I had to pick one other tech that I'm most excited about for immersive tech, it's 5G. Where all of a sudden we can render in the cloud and send that data fast enough to be usable. I mean, that changes everything.
I can only agree with that.
Actual fidelity.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you can actually render something like a light field on a server and being able to fast enough transfer it back to the device with a short back loop that you have in 5G, you can basically do this crazy rendering on the server, basically having some kind of rendering decision trees. You have, let's say, way more calculation power in the cloud than your small device, and then you can make even more portable, even less energy consuming and better devices, and actually be all the time connected to this cloud via the 5G network, which is definitely enough regards the speed and also the data connectivity and also the latency to do this magic. I mean, this would basically mean that we would not necessarily need this big tower we see in front of us, but could really do everything we do right now in VR, even with the next standalone Oculus device, right? Mm-hmm.
And with that, I think I want to thank Ellis for joining us today. And how can people find you and if they want to contact you?
Find me on Twitter. I'm just at Aldous Sipelins. And yeah, happy to send you any links to papers or prior work I've done. And hope to see you guys at future VR events. I'll be giving a talk at Augmented World Expo soon on sort of skill training and XR and what XR means for human research.
Fascinating. If there's a video that gets recorded, we would love to post that as well.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Because we like to follow up with all our guests. Peter?
If you're actually eager to know more about this Bow project that you have mentioned before, I think we recorded in video your talk during the VR days in Amsterdam. And I think it's posted on the Facebook page of Research VR. So we actually had you ready as a half guest because I think I recorded and streamed the whole science sessions there. I just remember looking through the catalog. And also, if Azad doesn't mind, I will plug the next episode of the Base Stories podcast, because I actually managed to get during the event in Berlin where I was with Sarah, the guy who's basically the artist behind Superhot. He's called Piotr, and he was basically explaining how the spatial cognition part that he basically tried to incorporate in the game actually helped to make exactly how you described the game.
That's fascinating. It blows my mind that Superhot was not a VR game to begin with. Like, how I don't even know how that would work on an Xbox controller by any means. But I guess it is. And with that, and we have a Patreon page, and our listeners, if you have been liking listening to this podcast, we'll get there. We've been doing this for 2.5 years, with essentially no advertising and no sponsorship. It would be amazing if you guys could help us, by supporting the podcast and helping us do this longer and, help cover the fees that we have to pay for the podcast. You can find it at patreon.com/thewizardofoz. It is under my name, or just search for Research VR Podcast. Second, we have the Discord community, which, basically anytime there's like things happening in real time, we have the discussions happening there, and also the episode post discussions happen in the Discord as well. So people know about the guests that are coming on the podcast, and we announce them ahead of time on the Discord, and then we have the discussions in there afterwards. So if you have thoughts about what we talked about here today, find us on Discord. It is all these links are in the description, and we hope to find you all there. And you can find the Twitter and the Facebook and the emails and everything there as well. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Aldous, again for joining us. Thank you, Peter, for coming in from Germany. And we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Bye.